Welcome to the Living to 100 Club podcast. Here's our host, Dr. Joseph Cassiani.
Welcome to all of our listeners tuning in to the Living to 100 Club podcast. This is Joe Cassiani, your host for this program. I'm very happy to welcome each of our listeners, and with Valentine's Day around the corner, at least when we're recording, I want to remind everyone who's in a relationship to take extra special notice of that partner of yours this year. Happy Valentine's Day to everyone. As you know, these podcasts are recorded and are available within 24 hours on the club website, living200.club. And if you have questions for our guest after listening, please email them to info@living200.club, and we'll do our best to get you a prompt response. Here in the Living to 100 Club, we focus on successful aging and staying positive, even in the face of physical setbacks and losses. Today's subject is one I am very familiar with: how do residents in nursing homes receive mental health services? Services that will help them adjust to physical illness or accidents, separation from family, and now during COVID, how do they cope with the very real worry about becoming infected with the virus? Our guest today will share with us her work as the Chief Psychology Officer for MediTelecare, a multi-state behavioral health group that provides services to nursing home patients via telehealth, that is, over the phone or on video lines for these essential professional services. She has a doctorate in clinical psychology from Antioch University, trained at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York, and has worked in psychiatric hospitals and a range of mental health settings, including private practice. She currently oversees policy, training, and program development for her telehealth company. Welcome to our program, Dr. Friedrich.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Very welcome. Let's start with a question I always like to begin with our guests. Sherry, tell us about the journey that brought you to where you are today, serving as Chief Psychology Officer for this multi-state organization providing mental health services.
Well, like many, my journey as a behavioral health provider has been one that's led me in a number of different directions, which has been very rewarding and exciting for me. But I actually started off my work doing deep analytic psychotherapy work in New York City, working with young adults mostly. And from there, I really got interested in working with children. I have always loved working with children, and I'm a developmentalist at heart. And so I've come a long way from there, professionally speaking, but started working with kiddos and got just really fascinated in development and did that for a number of years. I had a private practice treating lots of children, went on to work as the chief psychologist at a child group practice. And then began to find myself more curious about working with older adults. At that time in my life, I had a grandmother who was aging and starting to have some changes in her life and changes in her memory, and I was always very close with her. So I think that struck my interest. And I was also working with a lot of grandparents, working with kids whose grandparents, for various reasons, had become the primary caregivers. So I decided to really change directions and took a position working in nursing homes as a clinical psychologist.
Sure. And you've been doing that now for several years. And you're also the psychology director, as I mentioned, of MediTelecare. So you've seen a lot, I'm sure. In these settings, we encounter many different types of problems, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But give our audience an idea of what goes into your work week in terms of clinical work, training, putting out fires, troubleshooting. Yeah, just a quick
Sure, snack. Sure. Thanks for asking. My clinical work week, it really comprised of different things. So I continue to have a caseload of patients that I see via telehealth in nursing settings, some in traditional long-term care, some in skilled nursing or independent living settings. And I do individual therapy, cognitive assessments, a lot of work with staff around those patients and what their unique needs are. And then I also, as the chief psychologist, lead a group of about 30 other psychologists who are all over the country in different nursing homes, doing the same work that I'm doing, and really trying to advocate for services for this patient population, develop innovative ways of making services easily accessible to them, training clinicians on working with geriatrics, working with senior patients, and working very closely with facilities because they have a lot of changes they're encountering, of course, because of what we're seeing with this pandemic and how it's affecting nursing homes. But also we're just seeing a very different population present in nursing facilities over the last 10 years, I'd say, with people who have just really increased mental health needs. So helping the staff understand that so that they can be effective in the work that they're doing from a nursing standpoint.
Sure. Yeah, adjusting to the younger adults coming in. Yeah, and that's certainly the atypical admission that the facilities had seen in the past. I know I'd like to talk more about that too, but in terms of the oversight of your professional staff, you're available to them to do training and consulting and kind of program development with all of them.
I've done some work
myself. I know some of the challenges and some of the rewards that come with that, the hands-on contact. That's good. Go ahead.
It's great. It's amazing because it keeps you innovative. And working with such a large team and a diverse team, can really learn skills from other people, get great ideas from other clinicians, learn different ways of doing things. So that is one of my favorite parts of the job is that opportunity to work so closely with a team of really talented psychologists.
Yeah. I know one of the other important ingredients to these programs is how receptive the facilities are. And in my experience, that's evolved in a favorable direction over the years. They're much more welcoming now of mental health professionals to come in and work with their staff. I mean, years ago, as you probably know, a lot of questions about the benefits of counseling and psychotherapy, a lot of reliance on psychotropic medication instead. And now they're much more receptive to having the professional really be on their team. Is that your experience as well?
It is. It is mostly my experience. I would say that in most of the facilities I've had an opportunity to work in, they're excited to have us and really treat us like we're part of the care team, which is, as you know, it's so important. But that hesitation or uncertainty about psychology, it can still be kind of operating in the background. I think that, we live in a society that really values medication and utilizes medication and quick fixes. And there's still some uncertainty about what psychologists do. And one of the things that I try to do is sort of demystify that and make it more tangible and accessible so that we can show what an added value non-pharmacological approaches can be in the lives of these residents who are struggling.
Right. Yeah, that's such an important kind of process there to help the other caregivers, help the team understand the role that the mental health professional can play and how their approaches are different from, like you say, the medication or the quick fixes. We'll talk more about that as well. But give our audience an idea of what some of the reasons are for patients to be referred to the mental health professional. Why are they referred? What's going on for them?
Well, we see such a range in the types of residents that we see. The most common reason for referral would be things like depression and anxiety, of course, because it's so prevalent in our communities. So it's no different in the nursing homes. And then we also see patients who have more chronic, pervasive psychiatric conditions, people who have schizophrenia and are struggling with their thoughts and with their activities of daily living and their relationships. And what we are starting to see more, and I actually hope it continues, is people who are trying to make life adjustments and trying to maybe make sense of their lives or work through a difficult transition or improve a relationship. And those referrals are slower to come our way because those patients are what we will refer to as the more silent sufferers. You know, the person who's maybe lying in bed all day looking out the window, wishing that their daughter would call or wishing that their life would have gone differently. And they're not always the people who are first recognized as needing services. But we welcome getting to see those patients because they're in need too. It's just a different type of need that they have or a different level of distress that's not always recognized in a bustling, very busy nursing home environment.
Sure. Yeah, that's a useful term, the silent sufferers. I think we used to call some of this population the mass depression patients where, you know, refusing to eat or, you know, weight loss or kind of refusing to get involved in activities. Not necessarily indicative of depression, but you want to kind of scratch below the surface a little bit, right, just to see what's going
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And maybe help them before it develops into something that's more difficult to treat.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We don't typically think of preventative behavioral health in this country, but there's a need for those people to get some extra support.
Yeah, that's true. But on the other side of the coin, all of your services really have to be justified in terms mm-hmm. of what we call medical necessity. So it's
that's
not
right.
like you can go in and just talk with anybody who's admitted. There really has to be a bona fide clinical reason. I think maybe our audience, the listeners on this podcast may not understand that, you know, thinking, well, gee, it's so great to have the mental health professional. They can work with anybody. Mm-hmm. But in fact, there are some pretty strict criteria about.
There are, sadly. When you are dealing with insurance, which of course we do, especially because most of the people that we see are insured either with Medicare or Medicaid. Yes, there are certain rules certainly that we have to follow to make sure that somebody reaches the level of need and that the services are medically necessary and that they have a diagnosis that supports the services. So while we could offer services to somebody who doesn't have a diagnosis, certainly that unfortunately can become costly for people who would only be able to pay out of pocket where their insurance wouldn't cover them just to have someone to talk to because they're, let's say, lonely or feeling isolated. So it's a challenge, you know, an ethical challenge because we have to speak to the need and the medical necessity, but we also want to reach a wide range of people who would need and be appropriate for services.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a delicate balance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the referrals are for depression, anxiety, just transitions from maybe a healthier lifestyle to a more dependent situation in that person's life, transitions from, like I said, living independently and maybe then having some chronic condition or an acute condition that comes up, a fall or a hip fracture. So mm-hmm. a lot of those just really a big picture, a broad picture of reasons that the psychologist can be helpful. Yeah.
Yes. And then a big one, of course, that I didn't mention is memory loss. We do see a lot of people for referral who need assessments to see where they're at baseline because of some type of memory problem or concern that perhaps there's a dementia process unfolding.
Mm-hmm. Right. which is not uncommon. I mean, we see that in a lot of the missions there, right?
Yes.
What about the younger population? You mentioned more and more younger adults coming into skilled nursing facilities for nursing care. What are some of the reasons for referral for mental health services?
So what I really have noticed, and I don't have any data, unfortunately, to support this. This is just an observation, although I'd be curious to see, you know, what this really looks like. But we see the younger patients that we see tend to have more severe and debilitating psychiatric illnesses. And I think that makes sense because these are people who may have had difficulty accessing care. They may have had guardians when they were living in the community because they, you know, encountered or there was some concern about them being able to live independently and tend to their own behavioral health needs. And when these patients are more vulnerable to medical conditions, and when they get sick and they don't maybe have the resources and support at home to continue to live there safely and access the healthcare needs that they have, there ends up being sort of no other solution. And they either go to the hospital, and then, you know, the people at the hospital are concerned that they're not safe to go home, and they'll come to a nursing home, or their guardian will make that decision. And so we see a lot of facilities really servicing that population in a way that was not intended, but it's just a byproduct of, I mean, let's face it, there's really not good supports and services and housing for people who have serious mental illness in our communities. And so this is where many of those residents, much more than I think the average person would realize, many of those people end up in long-term care settings.
Yeah, because there are not more appropriate placements. I mean, sometimes I'm sure that is the most appropriate, but in many cases it's just a facility that can admit them where there's nowhere else in the community for them to go. Yeah.
That's right.
So a lot of the psychiatric problems in terms of maybe psychotic behaviors, history of schizophrenia, delusions, paranoia. What about accident victims like head trauma, motorcycle accidents, people coming in with, you know, acute kind of head injuries that
certainly
facility you're
seeing? Certainly.
Yeah,
definitely. And definitely in the older population, I think there are some good rehabilitation programs and facilities for younger people who have had injuries who are going to go through some sort of cognitive rehabilitation. But certainly older adults who have had some sort of accident, some sort of fall that resulted in a head trauma or sustained some sort of traumatic brain injury, those folks do often come into long-term care, and it may be just a rehab, and hopefully they'll go home and get some additional support. And then sadly, we see some people who really decline after that because it's a risk factor for having other layers of cognitive problems, and they, you know, can't go back to living the way that they did before the accident, which of course is very tragic and not only difficult for the patient, but their family, and especially the spouses that they sometimes go home without their loved one. That can be very difficult. And we really try to work and support the family in those instances because they really need it. Talk about a big life transition.
Sure. Yeah, educating the family about what to expect. Yeah, so there are the short-term stays, and then for people that are not suitable to be going back home, they convert to more of a long-term placement. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's helpful. Thanks very much. That gives our audience a pretty good picture of the types of services that the mental health professional can help with and provide. So let's step back a little bit now and talk about COVID, because COVID has been really impacting long-term care settings more than any other setting, as we know here in the U.S. The mortality rate is much, much higher for that population than for the general population. So What have you seen? How has COVID affected your programs and the facilities where you work?
Well, it has affected, I'll speak to the facilities first, because the effects of the people who are dealing with this day and night, both the residents and the staff at the facilities, it's just so profound how it's affected those people. For the staff, you know, just such a high degree of stress, anxiety, fear, burnout, and fatigue that we're seeing across healthcare workers in these facilities who are just showing up every day and giving it their all. And, you know, they're tired and it's taken so much away from the residents and put so much more responsibility on those staff members. So there's that sense. They remain, I think, optimistic and cheerful for the residents, but we know that it's taken a toll on healthcare workers and the residents that we work with, you know, are just so directly impacted. They've now been almost a year without, many of them, without face-to-face visits with family. They are confused, many of them who already had cognitive problems. We are seeing a much quicker rate of cognitive decline. So from the time somebody starts to have memory problems to the time that those memory problems are full-blown can be quite a long length of time in many disease trajectories. But right now we're seeing that people just seem to go to really decline much more quickly. And so sometimes, you know, sadly, a resident that I see, if I see them a few weeks later, I'll be sort of blown away by how much they've changed.
Really?
So
that's an observation.
And I think, and if you think about, you know, the things, you yourself working in this field, if you think about as a psychologist, the things we recommend people do for brain health, you know, don't stare at the TV, get out of the house, exercise, get fresh air, walk around, do activities, engage. All of those very things that we've been saying all along to support brain health have in many ways been taken away from people because of necessity. But I think it's very interesting to step back and look at what the implications of that are for someone's long-term cognition.
Yeah, because it makes a lot of sense, of course, because we always talk about being involved and, you know, getting out of your room and going to activities or, you know, visiting other people in the lobby or whatever. And the more engagement, the better, of course. So what you're pointing out is, you know, kind of contrary to what has always been recommended, where there is that not forced isolation, but that's what's in the cards right now. We cannot encourage that kind of social interaction. And you're seeing that decline in their mental functioning. It's very interesting. So it is taking a heavy toll on, of course, all parties there, the facility staff and the residents and the families too. And we hear about that all the time where families are, you know, just so insistent on being allowed to visit mom or dad or spouses or siblings, and they're not allowed to. It's a heavy toll.
What
are some of the adjustments that your practitioners are having to make during this period? How are they still delivering services?
Well, I think a major adjustment is just being flexible has been so important right now. And that is something that we can do to provide support, because our model is one in which we send a clinical liaison or a clinical facilitator, who essentially is a medical assistant, into our facilities to help conduct the visits in our larger facilities. And then we do have facilities that also rely on their own staff members to help conduct and facilitate visits. And, you know, with all of the caution that we have to take sending people into buildings, as well as when facilities are helping support the services, you know, we've had to be really flexible because and recognize that there are things that come up. You know, we may have a facilitator who has a slight temperature and can't go into the building for the day, or a facility may have an outbreak and not be able to support conducting visits. And so it's that balance, because the services are certainly essential and really important, and we want to provide access to those services, but we have to be able to be flexible and adjust to be part of a solution. So that's certainly something that we've noticed. I think another adjustment has been just recognizing our own, with our own clinical staff, when people need to seek consultation or need some additional support or need somebody to talk something through with. Because our staff members, our psychologists, our nurse practitioners and psychiatrists are seeing people who are really, really struggling. And there's that idea of vicarious traumatization. It's really difficult when your whole group of patients sort of in the same space and struggling. You know, that takes a toll on providers. And so there's extra support that's needed and coaching that's needed on that level as well.
So are your psychologists, other professionals, continuing to visit facilities, or are they doing the services mostly through telehealth?
Through telehealth. That had been the direction of MediTelecare, but which is the company where I am at. That had been our vision and our direction. And now that vision has really been solidified through COVID, and how much more sort of accessible we can make services in using that modality. The other thing with using telehealth that is so helpful for us is really being able to find qualified clinicians. You know, you probably know there's a shortage of clinical psychologists that treat older patients and understand that patient population. So having no boundaries in terms of geographic location really helps us recruit skilled clinicians who want to work with geriatric patients and are good at doing that type of work.
Sure. Yeah, so they don't have to drive an hour or 2 hours to get to a location. So the telehealth offers a real tremendous advantage. What would you say are the differences between traditional face-to-face versus telehealth in terms of providing these services? What are some of the distinctions? I mean, we know what the obvious ones are, that you're on a phone call or on a video versus standing next to the bed. But what are some of the maybe more subtle differences that come into play?
I think one of the things that I maintain is that I think there's a bit of a myth or a misconception that telehealth is like an easier thing to do. And certainly telehealth has some convenience. And so I think maybe that's why it's earned that reputation. But that is not true from a provider standpoint. I think that as a provider, when you're doing telehealth, because you are at a distance, you have to be more in tune. You have to be more aware of what's going on. You have to be more kind of on point to draw people in, to help people feel comfortable, because it can be foreign for some people, certainly. And so you have to have real skill at acknowledging that and helping people feel comfortable with it and feeling comfortable with it yourself, because how can we ask our patients to be comfortable if we're fumbling with the technology or, you know, just uncomfortable about it ourselves? So there's a lot of clinical savvy that has to go into being a good telehealth clinician so that it can mirror as close as possible the face-to-face encounter. And I put that responsibility on the clinicians. You know, it's the clinical person's responsibility. We give them the great technology, and then they have to figure out a way as a clinician to have their own comfort and then relay that to the people that they're working with. And it works. And I have to admit, I was a skeptic at first. When I was first asked to do my very first telehealth session, I did not think it could be done. I'm not sure why, but I just had that stigma about it. And I had always seen people face to face, you know, sometimes multiple times a week. And as I mentioned, in a very different type of dynamic office setting. And so I was a little skeptical about if this can be done, but it can. And the older adults we work with are so adaptive. It's pretty incredible. Actually, many of them really embrace it. And now that they're able to see somebody without a mask and greeting them with a smile, I think it's even more powerful right now than it was, you know, a year ago pre-COVID.
Yeah, that was my experience as well when I was doing telehealth. I think people just tended to underestimate the ability of the individual patient to operate under those conditions. And I remember many times turning on the screen and the person was there waiting with a big smile on his face, or, you know, looking forward to this contact because they were in a location that was so distant it was not possible to get, you know, easily in person. So I think that it is a factor that many people, you know, need to understand, that older adults are very accommodating. And just because it's technology doesn't mean that we can't handle that or they can't handle that, because they can. Of course, there are other limitations if they're impaired mentally, cognitively, but that
sure.
Could be a factor face-to-face as well. Yeah.
So absolutely. But it's funny. I have one patient I'm thinking of who loves when I visit, because she gets to brag to her granddaughter that she had a Zoom meeting, and she's just delighted about it. She's like, I'm going to call my granddaughter and let her know I'm Zooming too. And she's just wholeheartedly has, you know, embraced this technology and says, isn't it wonderful? And I never would have thought in my lifetime that I could do this, and here we are. And it's really lovely to see people connect with the technology and with the clinical services in that way.
Yeah, that's great. That's very reassuring to hear. Good stories. Yeah, I'm wondering about COVID and families, and you encounter this a lot with the families who are feeling so helpless that they cannot reach out or, you know, make connections with their loved ones. How do you help families with that? What are some of the solutions that you're finding to kind of bridge some of those barriers?
Well, I mean, I think the facilities, I'll give credit to the facilities that we work with, that the facilities themselves, I think, are doing a lot of outreach to the families. And supporting Skype visits when possible, and visits, you know, through the window pane, and doing everything they can to create that connection from a distance and in a safe way, of course. I see our role with families from a behavioral health standpoint more about providing the supportive services that one would need when they are experiencing grief. And so inviting families into counseling, into their own counseling, if appropriate and if needed, is a big part of the work that we do, because families are grieving and they are dealing with a loss, and there are families that are able to, they don't like it, but they accept it and find ways to sort of work within that understanding and adjustment. And then there are other families that are so devastated by it that they need counseling services. They need supportive services. Certainly, you know, you hear a lot of people who are experiencing grief, blaming themselves, having excessive guilt. Like, you know, if my mother didn't live at the facility and I had brought her home, you know, we wouldn't be in this situation, that type of thing. And so that's something that is more than just a call or a reach out and a connection. That needs to be a more in-depth conversation that I think is best suited for somebody coming into their own treatment, working with a separate counselor than the one that sees their family member, of course, to get additional support. So this is one way that I think about our role working with families.
Yeah, that's such a valuable service, really indispensable. And, you know, it's sad to think of facilities that don't have access to these kind of support services from the mental health professionals. So you're certainly in the right place at the right time, and you know it's unfortunate that we can't be in 100% of these facilities. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that. So beyond patient care, I'm curious, what do you do to develop better relationships with the staff? And you mentioned early on that you offer some training and kind of insights about how to interact with patients and, you know, strategies for dealing with maybe uncooperative patients. What do you do to develop these consulting relationships with the staff?
Well, I'm glad you asked about that, because that consulting piece is so important for the work that we are doing. Consulting is, you know, it's not something all psychologists are experienced at doing. It's a separate set of skills, but it's an important one, and it's something we nurture in all of the clinicians that are on my team, because there's a huge consulting role when you're working within a system, and we're there to make things better and improve the life of the residents, but also to alleviate the stressors that the staff are experiencing. So a couple of things that come to mind. One is that we train our clinicians in a consulting manner, meaning that we educate them about the system that we're working within. We provide clear guidelines on what their role is within that system, how they can be helpful, how they can partner, about the importance of supporting and listening and being empathic and not blaming and not being judgmental, but also not being afraid to be an authority on a subject matter. So that's all part of the initial and ongoing training process for our clinical staff. And then they form, inevitably, their own unique relationship with the facilities that they service. And most of the time, that is a very harmonious relationship that evolves, like any relationship, based on trust. So after the provider is there for a while and the staff develop a good experience and they get helpful tools and somebody to comfort them when they're stressed about something going on with one of the residents, that relationship, every time you have that interaction, that relationship gets a little bit stronger. And I think that's how we become part of the treatment team at these facilities. Another way that we help the facilities that we work with is through direct education. So we've done a lot of different types of behavioral health trainings and in services on topics that are important in this industry, like this year, for example, trauma-informed care was a really big topic, because that's something that CMS is now really emphasizing. So how to teach a nursing home about trauma and what it means to be sensitive and informed about trauma, and how to implement that facility-wide. That was a huge undertaking for us last year. And then we train on other topics, like how to treat younger adults in a nursing home setting, or dementia trainings. And the thing we always say to our customers, our facilities, is, you know, each facility is its own unique place with its own unique set of needs. So if you have a particular need for training your staff, maybe it's a particular subsector of the population, like you're seeing a lot of veterans who have PTSD, we'll put together a training plan and implement that to help build their team's confidence and skills in the work that they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's tremendous work. That's great. And I really want to emphasize the fact that these services are not billable to the patient's insurance when you're talking about education and consulting and, you know, being available for these different team meetings and all that. Those are not billable services to the patient's insurance. So that goes above and beyond. Yeah,
it does. But, you know, and the way that we think about it is that we're treating the residents. And so if we can empower and educate and train the staff to be more effective, the byproduct of that is that our residents that we're caring for are going to do better and feel better. And so it's really a win-win, because it helps the patients and it helps the staff at the facility. So it's why not? It's something that we feel really strongly that we just have to do.
Sure.
Part
yeah,
of the work.
No, I've often thought at times that if we do a really good job, we don't need to have psychologists in these settings.
That's right.
Job insecurity.
That's right.
But it is. You're giving a lot of skills to the CNAs and the nurses and the activity staff and rehab department and people that may not know how to deal with some of these issues when really they can include it as part of their daily routines, and it's light years ahead of what they were trained for initially, right? I mean, that's how I see it.
We always joke around because some of the best questions that we get on our in-services are somebody in the business office or somebody, you know, somebody cooking in the kitchen. And we love that because it's great because they want to engage and they want to understand. And if more people were curious and want to engage and understand, what a better world we live in and what a better experience that the residents will have at a facility.
Yeah, well, this is great. Thanks for really putting the spotlight on this really vital role that psychologists, mental health professionals have in these settings. You know, our podcast and the name of my company is the Living to 100 Club, so I'm interested, what advice do you have for our listeners about living longer and living healthier?
Oh, goodness, what a great question. I think that my first piece of advice that I give to everyone, which was given to me by my husband's grandmother, who was the first female PhD, went back for her doctorate when she was in her 60s. And so she's really somebody who unfortunately she passed away last year, but she's really inspired me to go into this work. And she shared with me, which I now share with the people that I know, the importance of life, being a lifelong learner, and that kept her sharp and interested and engaged and got her through some really difficult times in her life. And so I think that that's something that's really important, that idea of lifelong learning, and it goes back to that piece of being curious and keeping engaged with the world. And I think the other piece of advice that I would give people is just about the importance of nurturing your relationships. And I, as a psychologist, that's always been important to me and in my own personal life. But just now with everything that we've all collectively gone through with COVID, I think that what we're realizing is at the end of the day, the most important thing is our relationships and our connections with others. And when I have sat with people at the end of their life, that is what they want to talk about. And that is what, when people have unresolved grief and conflict in their life, it's never about money or work or beauty. It's about relationships. And so that's something that I think I've really taken from the work that I do.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. That's some beautiful advice, just very tender thoughts there. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Well, again, thank you, Sherry, for, you know, sharing this important work that you do and that your practitioners do and other mental health professionals around the country. So it is time to wrap up, but before we close, let me remind our listeners about a few items. Be sure to visit our website and subscribe to our email list for our newsletter and announcements, or sign up for our VIP membership, where you can enjoy opportunities for greater engagement with our experts and with one another. And be sure to go to livingto100.club/9tips for my 9 tips on maintaining a positive frame of mind as we age. You can also pick up a copy of my book on Amazon, Living Longer is the New Normal. I think that whatever age we're at, inspiration and a positive mindset can be put to good use. That's my message in this book. In fact, all of my writings, podcasts, and our videos. So, Sherry, again, Dr. Sherry Friedrich, it looks like we're out of time. Thanks for being a guest on our show. For those who might want to contact you, how can they do that?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you for having me. And best way to contact me would be through email, which I check religiously, at Sherry, S-H-E-R-I-E, dot Friedrich, F-R-I-E-D-R-I-C-H, at Medi, M-E-D-I, Kelly, T-E-L-E, care, C-A-R-E, dot com. It's a long one.
Sherry.Friedrich at meditelecare.com. Well, thanks again, and thanks to everyone for listening to this episode. Hope to see you next time.